The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Hell nah, I ain't sleep today, but I'ma be okay. Miss my family on the East.
Strike three.
Yeah, I can't leave LA. Every meeting that I be in, trust me, I just lead the way. I flinked three times before three today. Piece of cake. Never gave a
right
by what the teachers say. Cause either way, I'ma just do me and she said me too.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis, Arden Zwelling, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is Mike Studd talking about Marcus Stroman. Arden, you've heard this song before, right? You have to turn on your mic to speak.
Once or twice.
Yeah.
Normally they turn on the mic for me.
Oh, sorry. Okay. All right.
It's the kind of treatment I usually get around here.
Yeah.
When you bring in the big guns.
Can we get Marcus Stroman's verse queued up on this song?
How long do we have to wait for that? Because I'm not willing to wait much longer to hear it. Lots to get to on this fine radio program over the next 2 hours. Hey, there's Mike Wilner. All right. Turn this off. We're going to talk Blue Jays in just a second. Also, Raptors go to London. They win again. They've won four straight. A more underwhelming second seed in the Eastern Conference. I don't know if you can find one. Leafs also, they appear to be on the verge of completely rocketing down the Eastern Conference standings. Also, it is divisional weekend in the NFL. Lots of time saved for that as well. But we do start with the Blue Jays, and it's kind of been an interesting offseason, to say the least. Some moves of significance. Jay Happ was obviously a big signing. Say what you will about the guy's ability, bringing back Marco Estrada. And now we're into the arbitration hearings and numbers being passed back and forth, and whether or not it means anything, because the two sides went to arbitration a year ago. The Maple Leafs beat, or the Blue Jays beat Donaldson in arbitration. He made less than he would have liked to have made last season, and all he did was go out on the field and win the American League MVP. Now, this year, they're separated by $500,000, both in the $11 million range, and the guy is the defending American League MVP, Jordan. Does it mean anything? Because if you read Shai Davidi's piece on Sportsnet.ca, he's not saying 100% that it's going to ruin Josh Donaldson's season, but maybe it's a little bit murkier, the waters, considering where this team might be in a year from now without Jose Bautista and possibly Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah, well, I see why you would say something like that and why you could think about that looking at it from the outside, just because, you know, what the heck? It's only $450,000 we're talking about here, and this is a team with a payroll supposed to be around $140 million, and you want to keep your best player happy. But at the same time, Donaldson's got a couple more years of arbitration, and every $450,000 you give to him now is going to be an extra $450,000 times whatever the next time he takes you to arbitration. And, you know, for a club that is on a budget and dealing with the Canadian dollar, whatever you might think of that, I think you got a penny pinch now, because you're going to be pound foolish later with Donaldson, you hope, anyway.
These arbitration hearings seem stupid. Like, not... And here's what I mean by that. Baseball has moved on from caring about RBIs, right?
Right.
Like, that's a big thing in arbitration hearings, that you have to argue that you had more RBIs than somebody else or less RBIs than somebody else, Arden.
Well, because the reason they do that is because the arbiters are basically the layman, for lack of a better term. They're people who aren't familiar with
the
game.
That's stupid, isn't
it? But then they could be, if they are really involved in the game, they could be influenced by certain things.
Okay,
right?
Well, why don't I just tell them, like, well, here are the stats we need to work with here. Like, I'm sure they're given a mandate.
What do you mean? Like, tell the arbiters, like, go learn everything about wins above replacement and
here's what's important
and about all this stuff. Or, like, I think they try to make it as simple as possible for these people.
Well, so they're talking about pitcher wins and, like, RBIs. It's just, it just seems
saves.
Like... Okay. Well,
time, like games played, at bats, those
games
are huge.
That's a real
plate
stat.
Plate appearances
though.
Is huge.
Yeah, like, those are real stats. Those are important statistics or counting
so those
numbers.
Are yeah, those are factored in.
What do you make of the fact that they're going to arbitration again with Josh Donaldson? And I guess we assume he's going to arbitration because that was the rule under Alex Anthopoulos. If you exchange numbers with an arbitration eligible player, you were going to a trial unless you could figure out a multi-year deal with the player, which makes no sense with Donaldson, unless you're going crazy and you're going to buy out some of his free agent years, which would be a massive deal. And we've heard no rumblings of that, and I can't imagine why you would do that. So it looks like they're going to an arbitration hearing, unless you believe that maybe the rules have changed.
Well, I mean, we don't know. We weren't in the negotiations. Many things could have happened here. Maybe neither side had revealed what they were filing at until they actually filed with the league. So maybe neither side knew they were really that close in terms of where they were really willing to go. Maybe they didn't talk that much. Maybe, it was a game of chicken where nobody blinked and it just ended up going to arbitration. Maybe they were working on a multi-year thing and they weren't really concerned with what the 1 year rate was going to be. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were working on a multi-year thing. There's a lot of things that could have happened here. It's hard to believe that they both came to the table with those two figures just separated by $450,000,
right,
and weren't willing to at least meet in the middle and compromise.
Yeah, and they didn't talk about it and sit down and go back and forth. If they had done that, you would assume that, both sides would get a deal done in good faith. So they're just filling out paperwork.
Unless the Blue Jays said, this is as far as we're willing to go. And where they went was what the same raise that Chris Davis got 2 years ago.
$7 million.
Through arbitration, right? As a similar player to Josh, he's the closest comp. He's not a perfect comp, but he's close. And that was a record raise for a second-year arbitration guy. So they said, we're not going to set any records here. This is as far as we are willing to go. And it looks like Josh Donaldson's camp tried to say, well, there's been inflation since then. Josh Donaldson has an MVP, which Chris Davis didn't. He plays better defense at a more premium position.
And the argument against it was, Davis had more RBIs.
And Davis had more home runs than RBIs. That's right. And really, for baseball people to argue that would seem silly, but they're arguing what's going to be valued in the arbitration process by the arbiter, right? So really, it's applicable.
And they will be arguing it against the arbiter when they actually go. So why not take that into account when you're setting the money?
Those are the grounds that you're arguing upon, right? So I think it is interesting the way that the sides came in. I feel like there's more to this story than what has been told, and we probably will never find out what the negotiations were. I don't think feelings are going to be hurt is what I'm saying. I feel like either...
Because baseball players don't have feelings. They're robots. They just play the game and then they go back and then recharge themselves.
Well, but they did
closet.
It last year and nobody had any feelings. Yeah. And Josh Donaldson came on and played his butt off and won an MVP award. And now he's going to get another big raise and he's probably going to get another huge raise after this year. So he's going to get his, as he said on the radio this week.
And last year was much, much worse because the Blue Jays beat Josh Donaldson and they took basically $1.5 million, $2 million away from him by beating him in that arbitration case. And that affected this year's.
Exactly.
So that means this year, Josh Donaldson this year, if he had won last year, we'd be talking in the $14 million instead of the $2 million, or sorry, instead of the $12 million range.
Right.
So he lost money last year, still went out and won an MVP.
Well, is that why maybe the $450,000 is more important than we would like to think? Yeah. Because it seems like simple enough, but... You look at the next couple of arbitrations.
Yeah, you multiply it every time, right? Because you're giving him a raise based on the percentage of money he's earning now. So, say he gets a 40% raise, that's an extra, oh man, it's too early in the morning to do math.
It could be the ultimate penny pinching. It could be that you're saying, look, we're kind of up against our budget right now.
Which appears to be the case.
And we've got to try to find a way by next year to re-sign Edwin Encarnacion, to re-sign Jose Bautista. That ain't going to be cheap. And this Canadian dollar is plummeting. And with every decimal point that it goes down, it just bleeds the Blue Jays and really any Toronto sports franchise involved in North American pro sports. So it absolutely could be that they're saying, yeah, we'd like those $450,000. Sure.
You mentioned it, and Blue Jays have $67.5 million on the books already in 2017. That's for four players under contract for that amount of cash, almost $70 million. The re-signing of Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion is going to be one of the bigger storylines come spring training, which is actually pitchers and catchers about a month and a week away from reporting to Dunedin, so fast approaching. There's a couple of different aspects to this. One is, optically, it doesn't look so great, and certainly part of it will play out with how well this team does during the regular season, the narrative that's written at the end of the year if both guys remain unsigned going into next offseason. But the other part of it is Jose Bautista's 35 years old. And Edwin Encarnacion is just a couple of years younger than him, and he doesn't have much of a position. He's a first-base DH guy. Well, Jose Bautista, you figure, is going to eventually move into that type of a role. But they're, right now, two of the premier power hitters in all of baseball, and yeah, 35 isn't 40. They're going to get their money somewhere. Should the Blue Jays be super aggressive in signing them? Also with the caveat of $67.5 million on the books already for 2017, Jordan. And plus, it would be real ugly to see those two guys stay within the division either with the Red Sox or the Yankees.
Yeah, the word optics that you used is just so apt, because the way that this market reacts to everything that this franchise does or doesn't do, I think we've seen in this offseason just how nutty it can get with the whole David Price fiasco, and did they talk to the agent and did they offer him a contract? And, you know, very soon it's going to be, did they sit down with Edwin Encarnacion and talk about an extension? Well, was that sit down in person or did they talk on the phone? And, you know, was Edwin, yeah, was Edwin drinking tea or coffee? Like, it's just the optics of the situation preoccupy everybody in this market to an absurd extent. And then you end up, what you end up doing is you end up debating whether or not something that the organization is going to do behind the scenes and hopefully not talk about until it's done, or at least until there's been significant progress made. Do I think that the Blue Jays want to bring those two guys back? Absolutely. Sure. They're aware of the optics too. But do I also hope that Mark Shapiro knows that Jose Bautista is 35 and Edwin doesn't play in the field and these guys are not at the peak of their careers? And do I hope that they take that into account and don't overspend just to please a rabid fan base that has been looking for any reason to criticize the new guy? Some of those criticisms are valid, some of them aren't, but what you can't do is let that upset your game plan.
Arden, do these guys, does either one of them, now we know the, at least publicly, what we've heard is that Edwin Encarnacion's camp has set a deadline of opening day. They will not negotiate past opening day, whether that's true or not, and whether they're close to something and they go, you know, a couple of weeks into the season. Seems like that might be a reasonable position to take. And it seems like you're reading the tea leaves. He's the more likely guy to be re-signed because he's a couple years younger and he wants to be a Blue Jay. Both guys, we're hearing, want to be Blue Jays, but that Jose Bautista is more the guy that wants to see what his value is on the open market. What do you think the percentages is of either guy, one of these guys, being signed to an extension before opening day?
I can't put a percentage on that, but I mean,
I
think that
you
the,
could
the post,
you just make it up.
Yeah, I think that post the arbitration process and in spring training, the Blue Jays will, like, front office will have some time to address these things. They've been very, very busy. When you talk about preparing for nine arbitration cases, that's an insane amount of work. Like, that's crazy.
But they only have two now.
But they had nine until,
yeah, but only two now,
less than 24 hours ago.
And they had to negotiate with the other seven. So.
Yeah, I don't think that they, you know, as soon as they signed those guys yesterday afternoon, they flew out to Tampa to see Jose Bautista, right? Like, so I think that it you know, they're going to have some time to properly address these things and go through them. We'll see. I mean, who knows? Before the season, generally that's when you'd like to get it done. Yeah, but we've seen in-season extensions happen.
Do you want to pay 36-year-old Jose Bautista $20 million plus a year over 5 years?
I might. Jose Bautista is one of the best hitters I've ever seen
he
in
is.
My life.
And he's tremendous.
His skill, like...
And he seems like he's a guy who... And he's had his injuries throughout his career. He's been relatively healthy recently, but he seems like he has a great... workout regimen, for whatever that means.
He's in great shape.
Seems like he's in good shape.
Absolutely.
And not only that,
he
wasn't an everyday player for a big chunk of the early part of his career, which, I mean, I'm not so sure because I'm not the baseball guy the way Arden is, but I know in other sports that, you know, miles on the body is a real thing and it does impact you. And, you know, there's a difference between playing every second or third day and playing 162 games a year.
Yeah, I mean, with proper maintenance and with proper, you know, and that's the thing is Jose Bautista has really invested a lot of his time in, you know, in stretching, in, you know, flexibility, in yoga and things like that.
And booster juice.
Yes, that
I was
going
to say, yeah.
He's invested more of his money than his time in booster juice. But
no, I think they've invested their money in him. I think it's the other way around.
No, he bought like a franchise.
Oh, did he?
He owns a booster juice franchise.
Just one? Yeah.
I don't know the exact number of booster juice franchises that he owns. Don't have that information
you
with me.
You got to be
I could
prepared
talk to you about
you
why Jose Bautista might hold up into his late 30s, though, if you want to talk about that.
No, booster juice.
You know, when you talk about, like, skills and talents that project into your late 30s and even early 40s, plate approach, discipline, strike zone vision, those are the things that Jose Bautista is better than arguably anybody else in baseball at. When that guy says that was a ball... It was a ball. When
generally,
he says that was a strike, It was a strike. You can go back and look at it. It's very, very rarely is he wrong. And he's that's the kind of stuff that allows you, even if you lose a bit of power and a bit of bat speed, as you get older, that stuff allows you to still be a successful hitter late into your 30s and even into your early 40s. That's why I'd have no problem paying him.
Well, Edwin Encarnacion, kind of the same deal as well. His plate approach, his ability to recognize a ball and a strike, and his ability not to strike out as far as being a power hitter, right? Like, the guy's an extreme contact player.
He walks as much as he strikes out. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
It really is.
It's like, how many guys in the game do that?
No,
right? Like,
not many.
You look at what the Orioles are.
35 home runs do that. None.
You look at what the Orioles are paying for Chris Davis to hit a similar amount of home runs as these two guys. Strike out 200 times, right?
Yep. It's absolutely true. He's Arden Zwelling along with Jordan Heath Rawlings. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Also this week, some interesting stuff coming out of the Blue Jays world and Ben Nicholson-Smith reporting that the Blue Jays were at least in contact with Yovani Gallardo's camp, free agent right-handed pitcher for the Texas Rangers, which it came after Mark Shapiro was asked by Bob McCowan on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, about Gallardo, and he said, yeah, it's absolutely a type of guy that we would like to add to this team, but is there room under this budget? I don't know. There's definitely questions there. I thought there were some significant questions there. There was also rumblings that, yes, because you're going to have to give up a draft pick for a guy who was qualified in Gallardo, that maybe you'd recoup that by sending away R.A. Dickey. You get some sort of younger player, some sort of prospect that's a little closer to the major leagues than the first-round pick you'd be losing in the upcoming June draft by acquiring Gallardo. I don't know if that makes as much sense, but if you have Gallardo and Dickey, like, this team is significantly better if you're going to have both of those guys, right, Jordan?
Well, that's the pipe dream. I mean, that's, fairyland, everything works out. We got an incredibly deep pitching rotation, and everybody goes into the season thinking, huh, this organization made some moves in the offseason after all. But, I mean, when you look at the budget, and Arden was just talking about the Canadian dollar, I don't see how you fit Dickey and Gallardo under that, which means you're probably committing to getting rid of Dickey if you go after Gallardo. And, you know, to be frank, this is a team that's clearly, clearly trying to win now. Dickey is a guy who gives them something that they lack without him, which is that 200 innings, rock solid, save your bullpen kind of outing. And, you know, I just don't know if you really are willing to risk a pick and a significant payroll increase just to get a little younger and swap Gallardo for Dickey. If you could get both of them, I mean, that's just a matter of opening the checkbook. And if the ownership feels like that's something that they can do, then sure, it makes the team better, but I don't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, with the qualifying offer for Yovani Gallardo, like, the negotiation starts at 1 year, $16 million.
Right.
That's where it starts. So, like, I can't imagine the Blue Jays have room to fit that into their budget right now. So you'd have to move out R.A. Dickey, but, I mean, R.A. Dickey is as close to a guarantee of 200-plus innings and a sub-4 ERA as you can get.
Yeah.
So, that's for $12 million. I mean, that's tremendous value. I don't understand why you'd move, unless something was coming back that was making you a lot better somewhere else.
Right, and that's the question. I can't imagine, though, that thing coming back would have to be a pitcher, like maybe a pitching prospect, but it would have to be somebody elite-ish, and if you're one of these supposed National League teams inquiring on R.A. Dickey, why would you be giving up starting pitching for starting pitching? Just doesn't make a whole lot of sense on the surface of it.
Yeah, it'd have to be a prospect type, but I mean, I don't know. Are the Blue Jays trying to rebuild that, restock that cupboard right now, or are you trying to win next year? Trying to win next year.
Yeah, you are, without question. Is there any discussion about R.A. Dickey being better than Yovani Gallardo? Because he seems pretty clearly better, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I think, are we still talking about Dickey being underrated, undervalued by the Toronto fan base?
Oh, absolutely. 100% he's undervalued. Yeah. For sure. He's very underappreciated.
Every time he goes out there and does his job and gives them 7 innings of 3 or 4 run baseball, which is, you know, great thing for this offense to be able to rely on. Mm-hmm. Every time he does that, it's kind of like, okay, you know, it was good. He didn't strike a lot of guys out, but I guess he got through 7 innings. And then every time he grooves a pitch or two and gives up 5 or 6 runs over 6 innings, it's, oh my God, can you believe, you know, the Dickey trade? And I think I saw Syndergaard starting for the Mets yesterday.
Yeah.
And it just, it all gets brought back up. And it's, you know, I understand why fans do it. I think it's super unfair to R.A. Dickey, who's done a fantastic job.
He had a strange year last year where he kind of stopped striking guys out.
Yes. And
right? Like, that was what was kind of weird. That was the weird thing about his year last year. You look at it, like, he still got back to what his kind of his career norms are, but he, if he even has them, because he's been so all over the place in his career. But what you'd expect from him, he kind of got back to that in terms of innings pitched, in terms of, you know, in terms of ERA, things like that. But he just kind of stopped striking guys out, and he got it done in a different way. And he did battle that back stuff, and he was kind of banged up and hurt for a bit of it. It was an interesting year for him. So I don't know, maybe the Blue Jays saw something and were like, oh, maybe R.A. Dickey, he's going to be 41 this year, 42. Maybe that's, you know, maybe that's not
41, gonna, yeah.
Oh, he's losing 41. Velocity.
Right. But for him, I mean, his knuckleball.
He's much better at a pitcher.
When the back thing was bugging him, you saw the knuckleball drop a couple of miles an hour, and it was flying out of the ballpark.
Yeah, that could be the difference, right? So, but it's still, I mean, Yovani Gallardo, we were talking about before the show, Yovani Gallardo, who gave up a ton of hits and a ton of home runs in Texas, put him in the Rogers Center. I mean,
And Texas played a little more fair last year, too. The last couple of years, it's turned a little bit more towards the pitching side of things, where it used to be a hitter's haven. What also is tied into the discussion of Yovani Gallardo, which I think, I don't know, I'm leaning more to it being a very, very much a pipe dream, and Mike Wilner threw some cold water on it yesterday on Twitter, saying his sources say there's nothing to it. What happens to Aaron Sanchez? Now, I know, Arden, you were talking to Sanchez, you were talking to Marcus Stroman, you were not in his rap, but you were definitely communicating with those guys. It seems like somebody's told him, or he's under the impression, that he's going to go into spring training with at least a shot to be a starting pitcher this year.
I think absolutely. I mean, I think he's absolutely going to be stretched out. I mean, this is the time. If not now, right, then you're basically saying he's a reliever for the rest of, you know, time. And he is one of your best young pitching prospects, with Osuna, with Stroman. I mean, who else, right? Like, he is. And remember, like, this is a guy who was part of, like, the Lansing three, you know what I mean? With, you know, with Syndergaard, with Nicolino, like, this is the guy that you kept. The Blue Jays have a lot invested in this. They drafted him as a high schooler. He's been at every level of the Blue Jays minor league system. So they have a lot invested in this, that I feel like they owe it to him to see what he could be as a starter. He's got to throw more strikes. He's got to be better against left-handers. But he was good
the last few starts as a starter before he got hurt last year, right? And then he just came back and went to the bullpen anyway.
That's what was tragic about it, was that right when he kind of started to turn that corner, that's when the lat thing came up. And that's why he's working right now with Marcus Stroman in Durham. They're actually in Florida right now, but they were in Durham for a number of weeks, working with the same trainers to help Marcus Stroman come back from the knee thing towards building up his core strength, building his back strength, and making him durable to be able to withstand what a starting pitcher goes through in a major league season.
Is this bullpen good enough without him, with the addition of Drew Storen, if Osuna's back doing his thing, and Brett Cecil, I guess, is the question mark, if he can return from his injury, be anything close to the reliever he was last year? Because people forget, like, this guy, I mean, as good as Osuna was, Brett Cecil was this team's best reliever last year.
And they settled with him for $3.8 million, which, when you look at what relievers were getting on the open market this offseason, if Cecil's anything close to what he was last year, that's one of the best one-year deals in baseball for a reliever.
He'll get paid next year. He's a free agent next year, and he's going to do very – if he has another season like the one he's had for the last three, he's going to do very, very well.
$8 million a year, $9 million.
Who knows?
They also settled with Drew Storen, avoided arbitration with him, which was also interesting. That there's a couple of bonuses there for games finished. And in hearing Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins talk about Storen, where he fits in with this team, they wouldn't commit publicly to Roberto Osuna coming out of spring training as the closer. I imagine if all things are equal, he's given the chance again. But Storen's certainly going to be interested in
we talked about this, right? Yeah,
on the in radio, being handed like the reins, did we?
Yeah, you were saying Osuna should, like, it should be his job, right?
I don't see a reason why it shouldn't. Do you?
Yeah, I'll build you a case. So Drew Storen in his career has been better as kind of a one inning clean slate, come in, get three outs kind of guy. And when he's had to go two innings, or when he's had to come in with runners on, his numbers have declined. So he's better in that role. Roberto Osuna, a guy who could be a starter someday, right? Like, a guy who still might be a starter for the
Blue Jays.
You
don't think that's this year, do you? Because I talked to Shai Davidi last week, and he threw it out there that maybe the Blue Jays are thinking about this being the year for Osuna in the rotation.
Well, at some point, this is where I'm getting with this, at some point you have to start building up that inning space. Like, you have to. Like, you can't have him go another year of 60, 70 innings. You have to start building them up. maybe Roberto Osuna becomes your Dylan Betances type, right? Maybe he becomes your, you know, 1 2/3, 2 innings per appearance reliever, and he shuts down the 7th and 8th all by himself, and you build up that inning space this year to 90 or even 100, even 110 out of the bullpen. You get a lot of value out of him that way while you don't have room for him in the rotation right now. Next year, when R.A. Dickey leaves, you can slot him into the rotation and give him that next boost, right? You build up that inning space now by just saying you're going to save Roberto Osuna just for save situations. Well, the Blue Jays win a lot of games by 6-7 runs. Roberto Osuna might not get used that much. So what's your mandate here, right?
And I feel like when the bullpen was in trouble last year, they used him in an inning and a half, you know,
that was
innings.
Early.
Yeah, early in the season.
Before he was the closer, right?
And then they don't want to burn him out. So, and he became a great closer. So yeah. He couldn't do much with it. But he was pitching multiple innings in relief well.
Yeah, exactly, right? And he did in the playoffs, he pitched multiple innings and did well. Yeah. I think you turn him into that's the theory I would float. So you turn him into Dylan Betances, he becomes that type. Then Drew Storen becomes your 9th inning, you know, when you have a 3-run lead guy, he becomes your closer.
Yeah, he came in and pitched multiple innings in the playoffs as the closer, though, right? Like, he was kind of the Mariano Rivera, right?
So move that up, right? It doesn't matter if he comes in, after 7 2/3 or after 6 2/3.
Well, the Washington Nationals would say in the playoffs it does matter whether Drew Storen's the last guy coming out to lock down a game, right?
Like, he had two bad outings.
Yeah. Right.
He came at inopportune times. I'll grant you that. But and he had two bad outings. You look at his greater body of work. He's been very, very good as a closer.
Well, obviously
he's got like more than 90 saves on his.
No question. Know. But obviously some smart baseball people in Washington thought enough of what happened in the postseason.
The same smart baseball people that brought in Jonathan Papelbon to close it out for those guys.
Very good point. Very good point.
Well,
thank you.
I mean, that was the decision they decided to make in Washington, and one of those guys no longer there. One of those guys maybe they wish wasn't there. One of them also strangled the NL MVP.
Smart baseball guys in Washington.
I don't know if they told him to strangle Bryce Harper, but that's what went down. Also, before we take the break, other baseball business, Chris Davis getting his money somewhat, a little bit more than the $150 million that was taken off the table by the Baltimore Orioles, but headed back. That affects the Blue Jays because it's still within the division. The Orioles still have a lot of room to make up. They lose Wei-Yin Chen. Mark Trumbo's a factor there now as well. But that was a guy they had to get, Arden. They had to bring him back. What did you make of the money, though?
I kind of thought it was going to be a bit more. Maybe I got a bit lost just in, a lot of the talk around it and what he was, supposedly holding.
And Scott Boras.
And Scott Boras. And, I mean, they were talking, a $200 million pact at one point, or at least they were floating out through several reporters that, this is what we're holding out for. You know, it's interesting. It's kind of like I've been, just kind of trying to search around and find a good comp. Like, it's kind of Prince Fielder money. It's kind of like what he got from the Tigers. It's kind of, I mentioned you, Mark Teixeira, earlier today that what he got in 2009. But, like, I'm coming around to your side that they're different players. They're too different. Maybe the Prince Fielder comp kind of makes sense to me. Like, Chris Davis plays decent outfield. It's not incredible outfield, but decent outfield.
Yikes.
Right? It's what he's
you
out
imagine
there.
Prince Fielder playing the outfield,
yeah,
too.
I like to imagine that. That sounds fun.
It's not like even an option to put Prince in the outfield, but at least Chris Davis can go out there.
He owns an outfielder's glove, at least.
He played a bunch of outfield games last year.
Yeah.
So I thought he was going to get a bit more money than he did. I really did. But, hey, he got what he got.
He did. He got a little bit more. And Scott Boras, obviously, you got the Orioles bidding against themselves because it didn't seem like there was anybody else.
We didn't hear anything about anybody else talking to him.
No.
Well, the Orioles apparently talked to Cespedes a bit as well and kind of thought about going that route. And, they tried to do some different things. I guess they tried to up their leverage. Looks like they didn't. What they really wanted was Chris Davis. And I think Scott Boras realized that and, got some more money.
Well, and probably makes sense to bring him back to that ballpark as well. Quickly before we have to go, Ian Kennedy also to the Kansas City Royals. He's a weird guy, by which I mean he had a horrible season a year ago. It was weird to see him decline the qualifying offer, but then he goes out and gets $70 million from the Kansas City Royals. He strikes out people, which is good, I guess. And we got to give the Royals the benefit of the doubt these days. They're the World Series champs.
Yeah, well, I mean, he strikes out people, but when he doesn't strike out people, the ball sometimes goes a long way. But, you said he was a weird guy. I want to know what's so weird about
him. Well, that he gave up so many home runs at that ballpark in San Diego. Yeah. That's difficult to do.
Yeah.
It is also weird that Adrian Gonzalez had his best power year years in that ballpark as well. So maybe we make too much of a deal of it.
I think the Royals are betting that their defense will help Ian Kennedy.
And no they defense do have, for home runs.
They do have very good defense. And they do, you know, it's not as, you know, pitcher friendly of a park as Petco, but it's still, as we saw in the Blue Jays playoff series, I mean, the Blue Jays had trouble hitting home runs in Kansas City. And the Blue Jays are the best home run hitting team on the planet.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I do think that I see the Royals angle to it. I'd rather have Jay Happen, you know, and Marco Estrada, frankly.
It's going to be an interesting season, and it's only a month and a week away from at least cranking up from pitchers and catchers reporting to spring training. When we come back, Raptors have won four straight, including the final game of their road trip in London, England, return home to play the Brooklyn Nets on Monday. They're second alone in the Eastern Conference. Are you looking at them as the second best team in the East? Are you looking at them as being able to contend with the Cleveland Cavaliers in an Eastern Conference final? I think probably not. We'll discuss, though, coming up next. Ben Annis alongside Arden Zwelling and Jordan Heath Rawlings at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Christina Rutherford.
To be an NHL rookie, it's quite the learning curve. Imagine you wake up one day and you're being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to play hockey. Grown adults are wearing your jersey. You're playing against childhood idols, and you're a hot ticket in fantasy drafts. Now add to that. Imagine you're a teenager expected to help turn around a struggling franchise. Jack Eichel knows exactly what that's like.
You know, sometimes I think I'm probably just a little too hard on myself, so I think it's important to give yourself a break and realize that things aren't going to happen overnight.
Or maybe, like Dylan Larkin, you're the hometown kid in Detroit, the rare teenager.
The team hasn't had a teenager in a while. The guys on the team have been welcoming, and I think they like having me around to teach me things, and so there's a new guy around.
We talked to eight different elite first-year players about their rookie experience. It turns out no two experiences are alike. And these kids are learning a lot of lessons, too. Some of them are pretty tough. In Winnipeg, Nikolai Ehlers moved into his first apartment in October. He'd never lived alone before.
Like, my first couple of nights, I was sitting until 6:30 and I was waiting for dinner. And it was kind of like, oh my God, I need to do that myself.
It's all part of the rookie life.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Arden Zwelling. Raptors wrapping up their road trip. It was real long road trip. Not in length of games, although, I mean, five gamers, pretty tough, pretty long road trip. Warriors had a seven-game road trip earlier this year, but the last game was in London, England. They won that one, too, so they wrap up the five-game roadie, winning the final four games on the road. Not exactly the elite of the elite in the NBA, beating Brooklyn, Washington, Philly, and Orlando. But you got to beat who's in front of you, who's on the schedule. They did. And now 25-15, second alone in the Eastern Conference. Still four games back of the Cleveland Cavaliers, but a game and a half up on the Bulls, who are in third right now. And they've been, I think it's reasonable to say, beset by injuries this year. Jonas Valanciunas out for a good portion of time. Damari Carroll in and out of the lineup seemingly all season long, now out for a prolonged period of time with the knee injury. And even with all that, Jordan, they are in second in the Eastern Conference, but I feel like people in this city are having a tough time getting real excited over this team. I feel like there was more excitement surrounding this team last year and a team that was built almost entirely around offense, and that you could have seen, maybe not the way they went out in four games and as badly as they did to Washington, but you could see the second half collapse a little bit, but there was more excitement for that team than this year for some reason.
Well, there were expectations that were still expected to be fulfilled last year, and everybody went into last year. Also, it helped that they got off to a scorching hot start, got everybody all excited, and people thought, you know, this could be a team that that goes or at least challenges for the Eastern Conference title, and, you know, it didn't happen, obviously. We've now seen a couple of first-round playoff losses for this core, and what happens in this market, and really in any market where they don't have a history of championships, is people want you to do well in the regular season, and then you do well, and they don't care until you do it in the playoffs. And I can't blame a single Raptors fan for, you know, looking at a win in London over the Magic and saying, okay, great, wake me up in April. The Raptors, by the way, not only are they second in the East, they're sixth overall in the NBA.
And they've beaten everybody ahead of them except for the Golden State Warriors, who they almost beat twice. So, I mean, all that being said, like, shouldn't people be more excited about this
but
team?
But what do regular season wins mean for this Raptors team? You know they're going to win that division. It's almost a lock. You know they're going to be the second, third, or at worst fourth seed in the Eastern Conference. So, I mean, you tell me what it means to know that they can beat the San Antonio Spurs, who they're not going to face in the playoffs unless they can get to the finals anyway.
Like, when you look at it closer, right, and you look at the way that they have played certain teams, you look at the two losses to Chicago, right, and mm-hmm. you know, what happened in those games, and you look at some of the games against teams that they should beat, and yes, they won those games, but it's not like they won them handily. And I think that's probably why a lot of Raptors fans get concerned, is because the Raptors haven't been very good at closing out games against teams that they should beat really well. And then you see them show up against Golden State and play amazingly. Or you think about the win over Cleveland like a couple of months ago, when, you know, that was a huge win, but it took a lot to, like, you could feel like how hard that win was.
They beat the Spurs too, who everybody's fallen over themselves over.
They beat the Spurs, but the Spurs almost came back. And like, I remember I covered that game. The Spurs, like, Kawhi Leonard almost like won that game back, right?
Right.
So, you know, it, like, the wins aren't exactly authoritative. I think
they're,
that's why.
You mean you need OT to come out on top on a road game in London, that you should be winning easily.
I think that's why fans are a bit reticent to really buy in. You add in the first round exits, especially against, you know, Washington last year, which is a series you'd think the Raps could win at least the game, and, you know, in
right.
that.
Well, and get annihilated in all four like they did.
Exactly. And then you look at the way that they've won and lost games this year. Like, I understand the hesitancy to buy in.
And the NBA is a league. The NBA is a league that is built on good teams crushing bad teams. It's built on having dominant powerhouses that, you know, can reel off 7 or 8 wins in a row when they're playing sub 500 teams, and the Raptors might do that, but you never, like you say, you never look at those wins and be like, yeah, I'm gonna turn this off in the third quarter because I know it's over.
Well, that's part of the problem as well, that their starters are having to play big time minutes. Now, it helps that there's no more fat Kyle Lowry. Certainly he's you hope he can hold up down the stretch of this NBA season, unlike what happened second half of last season. But yeah, to have Lowry and DeRozan playing 40 plus minutes a game against these bad teams in games you should be blowing them out, yeah, it might be a problem down the stretch because you can't afford to rest people.
Well, random January games against crappy teams, that's when Greg Popovich rests Tim Duncan and Tony Parker and those guys, right? There's a reason that good teams in the NBA give their stars nights off.
Yeah, I mean, Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan are significantly younger than those guys, but I do agree that it is concerning that these guys are averaging over 36 minutes a night. Like, I do think that you'd like to back off of them, but the Toronto Raptors' second unit hasn't really shown an ability to score when one of those guys isn't on the floor. Like, that's kind of been how they've had to stack it, with at least one of those guys on the floor to create opportunities.
Yeah, but to be fair, their second unit has been largely had at least one member of it in the starting rotation for most of the year because of injuries.
Yeah, and James Johnson, now the guy that's getting the start with Damari Carroll out. But yes, Terrence Ross, Patrick Patterson have been real wild cards this year, where I was expecting a lot more out of Patterson. Certainly the three-point shooting that we saw first half of last season, he had a chance to start in that four spot that eventually was won out by Luis Scola, who's been kind of a revelation this year at the four. And Patrick Patterson's been real inconsistent, although had a nice game in London, 3 of 5 from beyond the arc and 4 of 7 from the field for his 11 points.
It's a good word for it, inconsistent from those guys. Even like Corey Joseph, inconsistent. Corey Joseph has had some really great games.
Yeah, he's impressed
me, though. He's had some stinkers
by and large
as well, though, is the thing, right? Like, he has kind of ebbed and flowed. I agree with you. I think he's been a really, really wise pickup for the Toronto Raptors, but I do, like, inconsistent. That second unit, you don't find that consistency. DeMar DeRozan this year has had a career year, and he's been consistent as hell. Kyle Lowry, consistent as all hell. Louis Scola, every night, you know what you're going to get. I mean, some of the, you know, the second unit, you're not seeing that consistent production.
The thing about consistency, though, on a night in and night out basis, especially with second units, is you need to have a second unit that stays together, that practices together, that plays together in order to really pick that up. I think you see some of the best second units in the NBA are the ones that have been defined for a while, and guys have roles, and guys play together, and the Raptors just, and it's no fault of Dwayne Casey's. They just haven't been able to do that. It's been a necessity to put guys in the starting lineup.
Yeah, injuries have been a big problem for this team as far as the consistency of the lineup. I got about a minute here before we got to take the break, gents. The big issue, I think, for most people this Raptors season is looking ahead to the offseason. We know this season will be defined by the playoffs. They went around. It's almost all gravy at that point. You got to take that step forward as a franchise because you've never won a seven-game series in the history of this organization, so that would be helpful. But going forward, into the offseason, looking ahead to the 2016-2017 season, it's DeMar DeRozan. What do you do with DeMar DeRozan? He's going to opt out. He's going to get the max somewhere. Is it here in Toronto? I'd say that the fan base, certainly with the way he played in December, has started to come around with the idea of giving him max money because somebody's going to give it to him. And what else are you going to do with the money? Like, there's just no choice, it seems like, Arden.
I mean, we'll see with where the salary cap ends up with all the money that's rushing into this sport right now. I mean, like, it's a different world. You know, it's a different world. When you look at what, you know, Damari Carroll got, and people are like, how are you going to pay that much for Damari Carroll? Like, that's going to be the going rate for a player like that. Same with Corey Joseph, like backup point guard, like $9 million. Like, what are you, that's going to be the going rate. So, we're, you know, Masai Ujiri and I obviously has been thinking a lot about this. I'm sure he has plans and how he wants to construct this thing. But it is a new world. You're going to have to throw out everything from the past.
Yeah, it's totally redefined what dollar figures some of the key players are making in the NBA. And DeMar DeRozan, the way he's played this year, though, playing like a max player, and if he can hit the occasional three-pointer, that would be helpful, although he was 0-2 in London. When we come back, Jordan Heath-Rawlings is foaming at the mouth because it's NFL divisional weekend. So we'll let him
talk
NFL.
This is the best weekend of football of the year.
Next week will be good, too, but there won't be as many games. But, yes, it's very good. We'll break down all four games, and we'll spend a lot of time doing it in just a second. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath-Rawlings, Arden Zwelling. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis alongside Arden Zwelling and Jordan Heath-Rawlings. It's a divisional weekend in the NFL. Last time we get to see four games over a weekend because championship weekend, obviously just two games and then week off. Sorry, not a week off. The Pro Bowl.
You forgot the Pro Bowl.
And then the Super Bowl. So sad times ahead. So let's revel in the full meal of football that we get this weekend. Let's go through all four games, gents, because it gets underway today on Saturday. Chiefs-Patriots get it cranked up at 4:35 in New England. Of course, the Patriots, much better team at home. 7-1 they were during the regular season at Foxborough. The Chiefs, the hottest team in the NFL, winning 11 straight if you include their playoff win last week over, frankly, a rancid Texans team. And maybe the worst quarterback to ever start a playoff game in Brian Hoyer. At least one of the worst performances ever. They can defend. They actually started hitting wide receivers on occasion in Kansas City. Now, Jeremy Maclin, probably not.
Looks if he's like
not,
he's out. It looks like he's done.
Yeah, if he's not playing. If he is playing, he's very limited. But it looks like he will be out. And as much as you think, well, the Chiefs are this red-hot team in the AFC, and the Patriots really looked lame down the stretch losing to the Jets and the Dolphins in Week 17. I don't know. It's still Tom Brady against Alex Smith, isn't it, Jordan?
Yeah, Tom Brady against Alex Smith with Tom Brady at home and Bill Belichick against Andy Reid when Bill Belichick has had an extra week to prepare. So, you know, it's funny because this is the game that everybody kind of wants to talk themselves into the Chiefs because they are hot. They haven't lost a game since the Kansas City Royals won the World Series. So good times for Kansas City. But they've beat, I think, three teams with a winning record that entire 11-game win streak. Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the Texans.
And one of them was the Texans, which is really just a function of the Texans playing in the AFC South and everybody else being terrible too. So I would side with the Patriots just because you trust the guys that have shown that they can do it. But at the same time, the Chiefs have a formula for beating the Patriots, mm-hmm. and it's strong defense, playmakers on defense taking advantage of mistakes, and they basically just have to hope that Brady makes a couple.
It would be awesome to see them do it. See Kansas City go into Foxborough and beat New England.
I mean, the Jets did it. It's a similar formula to when the Jets went into Foxborough and beat the Patriots in the playoffs.
Yeah, it's... And similar quarterbacking, right? Mark Sanchez won a playoff game against the New England Patriots, but we like to forget. Well,
the New York Jets won a playoff game, and Mark Sanchez happened to be the starting quarterback for that game.
Well, would we say Alex Smith is a better quarterback than Mark Sanchez? Mark Sanchez can throw the ball, probably has a stronger arm, right?
Alex Smith is a good quarterback.
Really?
Yeah, he's good. Good is far from great, but he's good. And he's so underrated with his rushing ability. He is, I think, the third, maybe fourth best rushing quarterback in the NFL, which is impressive in a league that has a lot of rushing quarterbacks now and can really mess with the defense.
Well, and he does have a little bit of playoff success, right? That playoff game with the 49ers against the Saints and had that big play down the stretch. Like, he's done the occasional thing in the playoffs. Does this not change the outlook of him and the way we talk about Alex Smith? He needs to win a game like this before we put him in that next echelon.
I think he's a mindful quarterback, and I think that's not really sexy to, like, fans, you know what I mean? Like, he's careful, and, like, he's not going to make a lot of big mistakes, right? He doesn't throw a lot of interceptions. He's safe. That's the big difference between him and Sanchez. You can say, yeah, Sanchez has a great arm, but Sanchez also, like, you know, runs into a guy's ass and fumbles or, like, throws, like, passes that he shouldn't throw, right? Yeah. Like, makes really, you know, glaring mental mistakes. Alex Smith is, like, safe and mindful, and, like Jordan mentioned, you know, a lot of fans don't value that, but, like, he's decent.
He can read progressions, and he knows when to go to his second look, and he knows when to dump it off, and he just doesn't panic, which is such a huge thing in the playoffs, especially when you're facing a team like the Patriots, who will throw interesting stunts at you and blitzes at you, and you have to be prepared for it. You know, I hate it when guys like Alex Smith don't get the credit they deserve. And then when they do get the credit they deserve, everybody wants to talk about it like they could actually do it. But Alex Smith has no big game trophies on his mantelpiece. You know, he's never taken down anybody that's a signature win. And this is his chance.
So much of the discussion around the Patriots has been about health. Rob Gronkowski, his health, spent time apparently in a New England hospital Friday, getting his knee shot up. Looks like they'll have their full complement of wide receivers is Julian Edelman. He's going to be back for this one. How much does that factor in for this New England team? And how much can we take away from the last couple of weeks of the regular season where they really didn't look all that good?
Yeah, they didn't have much the last couple of weeks of the regular season. But at the same time, you got to imagine Belichick was just trying to keep his guys healthy. The Edelman thing, though, is huge because he changes the look of their offense. They tried to use Danny Amendola in his place. It didn't really work. I mean, that offense functions best when Edelman is in the old Wes Welker role, which he proved so adept at, and when Gronkowski can take advantage of the fact that defenses have to cover Edelman over the middle, because that's how Gronk gets loose down the field against linebackers, and that's how the Patriots kill you.
Like, the Patriots, if they've shown anything, Bill Belichick's shown anything, said he can be creative. And, like, James White could step into a slot receiver role and, you know, put up 100 yards. He's probably not going to get that much attention played to him, you know? Like, Brandon Bolden. I mean, they can do different things with their players. Like, they've got their system, like, kind of the genius of their system is that you can kind of plug and play a lot of players into it.
Yeah.
And they can have success. So, we'll see what they come with. I think Jordan's probably right in that we haven't, you know, Bill Belichick hasn't shown other coaches everything that he has in his repertoire right now.
And probably the best coach in the NFL as far as second half adjustments. So often they will come out in the second half with a house on fire, especially if they win the coin toss and they defer. That's a team that can totally change its identity at halftime.
And one of the best teams in NFL history at winning after a bye week, right?
Yep.
They rarely, if ever, lose after a bye week because you can't give this coaching staff time to prepare.
And they rarely, if ever, lose back-to-back games. But when they do, they're generally pretty good in that next game, which they've done down the stretch. They've lost back-to-back games.
It had been like 9 or 10 years since they lost back-to-back games against divisional opponents as they did to end the season. And part of that is keeping guys healthy. Part of that is also keeping plays off of film because you don't want Andy Reid watching whatever you did in the last 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah, they definitely went to the run game a lot in that Miami game, which was kind of bizarre. So the late game Saturday night, Packers in Arizona against the Cardinals. On the surface, it seems like the most obvious game of the weekend, well, depending on what you make of the injuries and whether Ben Roethlisberger plays in Denver, and we'll get to that in just a second. But yeah, the Packers showed a little something against Washington last week. I think we learned a little bit more about Washington than we did about Green Bay. But the Cardinals are actually Super Bowl favorites, even with what Carolina's done throughout the regular season. They already hammered Green Bay during the regular season. It was not that long ago either. But has Aaron Rodgers' performance against what I did couch as, you know, maybe not a great Washington team, he still played pretty well. And it's not a horrible Washington team. He looked like the Aaron Rodgers of old a little bit last week. And it's not like the playoff history of Carson Palmer is long and storied either, Arden. Does that give you any pause the way Aaron Rodgers played last week?
Maybe. I think that either way, Arizona's going to score a lot of points in this game, no matter what. And it's going to be, can Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers offense keep up with that rate of production? You know, is it going to be a Cardinals blowout or is it going to be a shootout? I don't know. But I think there's going to be a lot of points definitely scored by Arizona.
They sacked Aaron Rodgers 8 times when they met. And that was part of the reason why Washington could not slow him down. Because you give him time. He's still Aaron Rodgers if he's on his feet. He can't be Aaron Rodgers when he's on his back, which he was in the regular season matchup, but he was on his feet in Washington, and no matter the ineptitude of his wide receivers, if James Jones is your best wideout, if you have enough time, he will find someone, seemingly.
Yeah, possibly, but he's not going to get time today, for sure. And, I mean, if Aaron Rodgers can't be Aaron Rodgers unless he's on his feet, he also can't be Aaron Rodgers unless guys are open. Like, there's nothing you can do about that. And Arizona has one of the best secondaries in football. No honey badger. But, I mean, what does that matter when you literally are giving Patrick Peterson a list of Green Bay's receivers and asking him, who do you want to cover? And he just laughs and says, I don't care. Yeah. Because there's nobody here that would give a guy like Peterson any pause. I think the Packers' best hope coming into this year after Jordy Nelson's injury was that Devontae Adams would step up as the deep threat, and that would create the same sort of space that Randall Cobb had when Jordy Nelson was around. Didn't work at all. Cobb had a miserable year. Adams dropped everything they threw at him, and now after showing just a little bit, again, the Washington game from Adams, he gets hurt, and now you're looking at James Jones as a field stretcher, Jared Aberdeen. Like, these guys are nothing. The Cardinals have 3 wide receivers, maybe 4, who would all be the number one receiver in Green Bay. That's sick.
How much pressure is on Carson Palmer in this game? Because it's not his fault that he was injured last year, and it's not his fault that he suffered that catastrophic knee injury while he was QB of the Cincinnati Bengals, but he doesn't have a playoff win. He has 1 playoff game in which he played the entire game, and it was a loss to the Jets in a game I don't even remember, because I guess it was insignificant at the time.
Because he was with the Bengals, and everybody forgets all the Bengals' playoff losses.
And there's many of them. It's long and storied, but he hasn't done anything in the postseason. If he loses to this Green Bay Packers team, like, that's an ugly look for a guy who was in MVP discussions earlier this season.
He's had 2 opportunities in the postseason. Really, he's had 1, right?
Right.
Like, in one of those games, he threw 1 pass. So, really, he's played 1 postseason game. So to say he hasn't done anything in the postseason, it's not like he's had a bunch of postseason games where he's wilted.
Correct.
He hasn't had the opportunities. I like Carson Palmer a lot as a quarterback, honestly. I think he's one of the smarter quarterbacks. You read some of the Peter King stuff this earlier this year about, you know, how much this guy studies and how much work he puts in. And who knows, maybe that's what every quarterback out there is doing, but it is very interesting to look at how him and Bruce Arians really, really game plan and really get after kind of the cerebral side of things. I wouldn't expect him to falter.
It's just a perfect passing offense. When you look at what Arians can do with a quarterback, you know, we've seen him do amazing things with quarterbacks in the past. And then you look at the talent that they have at wide receiver, which is just ridiculous. Like, Larry Fitzgerald is obviously going to be in the Hall of Fame one day. He might have slowed down a little bit, but still gets you first down anytime you need it. Mm-hmm. And Michael Floyd, who took a step back last year, took two forward this year, and now looks like he could be one of those big, athletic, throw it up and go get it downfield receivers. And John Brown is just, he might be as fast as any wide receiver in football and can beat any DB one-on-one.
But doesn't it seem too obvious? Doesn't it seem
no,
like...
because they also have a great running game because David Johnson might be the best rookie running back. Like, it's unfair right now. They're more talented. They're more talented than the Packers at every single position on the field except quarterback.
No question about it. But sports are weird, which has made just, A little.
There's your
dubious.
Hot take on the game for tonight.
Sports are weird.
Copyright Ben Ennis.
They are.
Both those AFC games could potentially be blowouts, is the thing. Really.
Or they could both be tight.
Yeah. Or wait, one's AFC, one's NFC.
One's NFC.
My bad. Both those Saturday games could be blowouts.
Let's go to Sunday then. The game of the weekend, Seahawks in Carolina taking on the 15-1 Panthers, who did not lose a home game this regular season. These two teams met during the regular season as well. Seahawks weren't exactly the Seahawks at the time because that Seahawks team lost to the Green Bay Packers for some reason. So, I mean, you want to talk about sports being weird. Things change in a matter of months. And they escaped Minnesota. Did not really do enough to win the game. They need the gift of a missed 27-yard field
Nobody
goal.
Nobody did enough to win that game.
No. In freezing cold, frigid temperatures. And you wonder how much that takes out of a team playing in conditions like that, taking a bunch of hits. Because, you know, even in good weather, it takes a lot of time to recover from an NFL football game. But when you're getting blasted and it's minus 20, I don't know. And you're going into a place in Carolina where that team got to sit and rest for 2 weeks. That
and
seems
it's not just that.
One.
The Seahawks have played in three different climate conditions and three different time zones the last 3 weeks. Like, they've been all over the map here. And they're a great team. They obviously have the pedigree in this one, which is why I think the line is so close. I think it's at 1.5 going into tomorrow. I wouldn't even be shocked if it came down to a single point. But my theory about this game is that Russell Wilson and Cam Newton are the new Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. There's two quarterbacks that are going to go head-to-head for years and years. One of them has the playoff success early and really looks like the guy who might not put up the great stats but always gets it done in the clutch. The other one doesn't have the playoff success early but runs up crazy stats doing it all by himself. So this is, you know, chapter two of the playoff rivalry, and Wilson won the first one. Cam Newton has the better team in this one. So it'll be interesting.
Carolina's never been in this position, though, before. And you mentioned they've been in the playoffs. They've been a sub-500 team in the playoffs. They've never been the prohibitive favorite. Although, I guess I would couch that a little bit.
Prohibitive favorites.
But they are a favorite. Slight. And they were 15-1, okay? Like, it's a huge disappointment, at least, if they lose this game. They're the best team regular season-wise in the NFC, but they're facing the two-time defending NFC champions. They've never been a team expected to do anything in the postseason. I think that's fair enough to say. They're expected to do plenty. And I wonder how a guy like Cam Newton, getting his first taste of that, how he responds.
I mean, just look at what he's done this year. Really, he took such a step this year. Such a significant,
And we've said that about him a couple of times this year, is they've never been in the position to be the favorites, and then they kept winning games, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, at what point this year has Cam Newton not looked like perhaps the best quarterback in the league right now? You know, so I don't buy into the whole to the whole. Oh, it's the playoffs. It's all different. Like, still football. There's a bit more pressure.
Every NFL game is like a playoff game because there's only 16 of them.
Guys. I mean, there are the Andy Daltons of the world, right?
Oh, now we're going to hate him. Wow. Poor Andy Dalton.
Poor Andy Dalton.
Gets no respect.
Should he? Are you giving him playoff respect?
No, he can't have playoff respect till he actually wins a playoff game. Yeah. But my point is that Andy Dalton is a quarterback that 20 teams in the NFL would be super happy to have.
Yeah. 100%, if not more.
The interesting thing, though, because Arden was talking about just how good Cam Newton's been, is to look at that Week 6 matchup. Because I know, you know, you want to say Seattle was not Seattle, but, I mean, they still were. For the most part, it was the same players. And Seattle had Jimmy Graham back then, who had 140 yards in that game. They had Marshawn Lynch, who ran all over the Panthers, or at least tried to. And Seattle was up, I think, 20-7 in the third quarter. And then Cam Newton just led three straight 80-yard touchdown drives against perhaps the best defense in football, or at least what people were calling the best D, and put the nail in their coffin. And that's something that we hadn't seen from Cam Newton. You know, every once in a while, an athlete who's already considered really, really good sort of wakes up and realizes, oh, I can dominate this anytime I want. And I think that's what happened to Cam Newton. I wouldn't be surprised to see Newton run for 120, 140 yards on Sunday, just because that's the way it works for them.
Okay, and he had gotten picked off like twice early in that game, or at least in the first half, I think. And Cam Newton hadn't looked good, and then he just kind of just turned a switch.
Yeah, they looked like a mess. It looked like, oh, the Seahawks are waking up. These are the Seahawks we all remember, and then Carolina said no.
What is the insertion of Marshawn Lynch back into the lineup for the Seattle Seahawks do? Because I think it caught everybody by surprise when he didn't get on the plane last week. I would have been tempted to do the same thing going into minus 20 in Minnesota if I was harboring a little bit of an injury, but certainly didn't make the people in Seattle all that pleased about it. But now he gets the whole week of rest. He's one of those guys now, depending on how significant the injury still feels to him, obviously that plays a factor, but he didn't have to play in minus 20 last week. And he's a big part of what the Seahawks do. Does that change anything for you, Jordan?
I don't think it changes anything for the Panthers, which is the most important thing. I mean, they're one of the best run defenses in the league. You know, they have Luke Kuechly, who might be the best linebacker in football. They got a pretty tough defensive line to run on. So, I mean, and it's not like Christine Michael did bad things in Lynch's absence. You know, he showed that he might have a future in this league after kind of up and down early start. I think the key to this entire game is whether or not Seattle can stop Greg Olsen. Because, well, Seattle is one of the top five teams against wide receivers, one of the top five teams against running backs. They're the 26th best team defending the tight end. And when they lost that game to Carolina earlier in the season, that was because Cam started going to Greg Olsen. He hung 130 yards and a touchdown on him in the second half, and that was it. So if they can prevent this, they're going to make an injured Ted Ginn and Philly Brown and guys like that try to beat them, and they can't do that.
I think the key for Seattle is going to be, can you score through the air? And can Russell Wilson be as good as he was down the stretch? Can Doug Baldwin get open? Jermaine Kearse, like, can those guys be useful for him? I think, like, Marshawn Lynch being in this game, like, maybe, you know, he's going to get fed the ball a bit, probably early on, like, quite a bit, just to see where he's at and what he can contribute. But I do think if Seattle's going to win this game, they're going to have to score quite a bit through the air.
Yeah, and no offense to Doug Baldwin, who actually looked fantastic down the stretch, but now he's going to get Josh Norman, and that doesn't end well for most wide receivers.
It hasn't during the regular season. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Arden Zwelling, Jordan Heath Rawlings. So the weekend wraps up in Denver with the Pittsburgh Steelers taking on the Broncos, and a bunch of different interesting storylines to this one. One is health of the Steelers, and we know already that Antonio Brown is out, much to the dismay of Pac-Man Jones, who I guess has some apologizing
to
do.
He's very sorry.
Yeah. But Ben Roethlisberger, I'd be shocked if he doesn't play. Like, he's going to play.
He always plays. He plays through literally everything. You have to knock him over the head.
If the arm is physically attached to his shoulder, he will play. And, I mean, he played in that game last week where he couldn't really throw downfield, and he had a separated shoulder. So he will play in Denver. The real wild card, obviously, is Peyton Manning and what he can provide for this Denver Broncos team and how many one-and-dones in the playoffs he's had. He does have the Super Bowl title, and we'll give him that,
He's been to another Super Bowl, too.
Yeah. But overall, it's not been a story.
You're questioning the career of Peyton Manning right now?
His playoff career, his sub-500 playoff career, I am.
You're so focused on this, the play, like, performance in the playoffs.
How can you not be? Like, you're going to say Peyton Manning's a clutch playoff performer now?
That's not at all what I'm saying. But I'm saying I don't think the playoffs is everything for a quarterback's career.
I think absolutely it will be one of the top three things you talk about Peyton Manning's career when it's all said and done. It's why Tom Brady's 10 times the quarterback through, if you look at the...
Whoa.
So what, you think how do you rank the quarterbacks then? Peyton Manning's ahead of Tom Brady?
Peyton Manning and Tom Brady are the two greatest quarterbacks of their era, but to go out and say one of them is 10 times the best quarterback...
Okay, that might have been hyperbole.
Peyton Manning leads the NFL in literally every career quarterback category.
I'm actually shocked that you're downplaying a player's legacy because of their playoff success. Like, there's, without question, like, that is part of the evaluation of Peyton Manning.
Peyton Manning does have playoff success. He's got a Super Bowl ring. He's been to another one. And second of all, there's 53 guys on a football team. Like,
no question. But he's also performed poorly in the playoffs. And he's had good enough teams to win and has not.
In football, more than any other sport, it is crazy to judge one person at any position ahead of the team. And, you know, I'm not saying that that makes Peyton Manning a better quarterback than Tom Brady because he holds all these records. But what I am saying is that you have to look at them as 1A, 1B of their era, however you want to put them. And I don't care that Brady has four Super Bowls. Brady has the best coach of his generation calling the plays, which is worth more to me than...
Peyton Manning is the coach of every team he's ever played on, at least the offensive coordinator.
Which is what makes him better in my mind than Tom Brady, but you can have Tom Brady if you like little shiny things on your hand.
Which is, I don't know, the point of the game. So, I mean,
it's not
whatever
the point
way.
Of watching the game, though.
It's the point of playing it. Okay, so either way, Steelers go into Denver to play the Broncos. Everybody's hurt. Antonio Brown's out. And as much as it seems obvious that the Packers are going to lose in Arizona, I mean, with all their key players either hurt or out, I mean, a lot of people looking at this as a pretty obvious game. Is it?
No.
This is where you speak.
Yes.
No, yes. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, the Steelers, you got nothing. What's cool for the Steelers, you got nothing to lose. Coming in, Le'Veon Bell's long gone. You know, Antonio Brown's out. You know, Ben Roethlisberger might only have one arm. I mean, nobody's giving you a shot. So you go in with nothing to lose. And if you, even if you keep it close, people are going to say, oh, what a gutsy effort. You know, what a great, you know, they really went in and gave it their all or whatever. And if you win, people say amazing, right? So, yeah, you got nothing to lose. That's fine. If I don't, you know, I'm not going into the Peyton Manning thing, so I don't want to go down that road again. But, like, it's we'll see what happens.
The fun thing is that seeing how these guys have nothing to lose, it's almost the opposite of when Denver and Pittsburgh met in the playoffs a few years ago and Denver was starting Tim Tebow and they were the guys with nothing to lose and they were expected to just get smoked by Roethlisberger and Brown. And now the shoe's on the other foot, right? One team is starting a legend. The other team is totally banged up. They're missing D'Angelo Williams too, the Steelers. So you're down to like Fitzgerald Toussaint as your running back.
He actually showed a little bit last
week. He showed a little bit, but Denver is the best defense in football by like a country mile. And not only that is they get after the quarterback better than any other team in football. And they get DeMarcus Ware back this year, this week. So there's not a lot there for a banged up Steelers team. I mean, when you're missing Antonio Brown going against perhaps the best secondary in the NFL, if it's not Arizona, it's Denver. And I just don't see how the Steelers can pull enough together to do it. You would be relying on, as you said, Peyton Manning just giving it up.
Yeah, who has this storied history of playoff successes. So we're all looking forward to Peyton Manning going 350 yards through the air with four touchdowns, right?
Well, see, no, I would bet you that Peyton Manning gets like one touchdown and 190 yards because with this, what
with
they're doing.
Four picks.
Oh, wow. That's a bold call. But
I mean, the guy still leads the NFL in turnovers by quarterbacks, and he played half the year.
I'm not defending Peyton Manning's first seven games
like
of this year. Right. I'm defending Peyton Manning's career. But putting that aside, what the Broncos want to do, and this has been true for most of the year, is they want Manning to tone it down, to be a game manager, to hand it off, mm-hmm. and especially to do the short passes to Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders in open space and make them break tackles. And the thing with the Steelers is their secondary can't tackle. Their DBs can't wrap up guys one-on-one. And Demaryius Thomas is probably one of the top five guys hard to wrap up one-on-one. So that's what I expect to see. I expect to see a ton of yards after the catch and a lot of little dump-off passes and, you know, a 21-10 thumping, kind of like that.
They're going to feed C.J. Anderson and Ronnie Hillman a ton as well.
They are, but the Steelers are tough to run on. So absolutely. You expect a lot of screens to, like, Hillman. Get him open in mm-hmm. space. Get him isolated against those linebackers and defensive backs and see what he can do.
Well, one of the things I did not expect to hear today was defending of Peyton Manning's playoff record. But that's what we heard. So expect big things from
that's
him.
That's a mischaracterization of our argument. It is.
Didn't feel like it.
Absolutely is.
All right, so what we got a couple of minutes. So
what Jordan and I are trying to say is the playoffs are not the be all and end all of a guy's career. And it's in a game of football.
It's a significant part. I feel like you're underplaying it.
I don't know if I'm underplaying it. You play 16 regular season games and you might only play one playoff game. You're going to isolate that one performance as just because
you should play more than one on the,
are you going to make me bring
occasions.
Up Joe Flacco, Trent Dilfer and all these guys?
Sure. Who also have one.
That's
right?
my point. Yes.
Right. But they're not. Peyton Manning also has one, and he's played four teams with teams on teams that are significantly better than some of those Super Bowl winning teams He was unable to win playoff games.
I don't know how you can say that.
That he only won one.
I don't know how you can say that the teams Peyton Manning played on in Indy, which while very good teams, were significantly better than like those Ravens teams that won rings. Those teams had some of the best defense in the modern era.
But he only won one, and the one he won might have been the worst Colts team of that generation too, right? Like,
yeah,
that was not a good team.
He dragged them to that Super Bowl. It was great.
It's really hard for me to put all the weight of a win or a loss on one guy in football when that one guy is only on the field half the time, perhaps less than
If you're
going to
put all the weight of one win or loss on a guy in football, it better be the head coach.
Exactly. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's so hard to do that. That's like, you know, it's like pitcher wins, right? Like, that, it's the same thing to me. You know, there's a whole other side of the game that contributes to this.
It is not at all like
pitcher wins. Could go out there tomorrow and throw five touchdowns and lose.
But here's the deal.
And he could throw five picks and win.
Exactly.
Here's the deal. In those playoff losses, he hasn't gone out and thrown five touchdowns and they've lost, right? He's had some epic moments where it hasn't gone his way in the postseason.
Sure, but all that has to happen for that is for the receiver to run the wrong route or the ball to get tipped at the line. You know, there's so many things that happen in the course of a football game that it's really foolish to put all of the responsibility for it on one guy. If you want to argue playoff success, Bill Belichick versus Tony Dungy, I will give you that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, like, it's a fool's errand. How many quarterbacks in the last 10, 15 years would you say are these great playoff quarterbacks? Tom Brady's, like, the only guy. Because he's been on the best team of the last 10 to 15 years, which consistently wins in the playoffs. So that's the only guy.
What played for the best coach, designing the best game plans, and outsmarting everybody else. And Brady executes amazingly, which is what makes him great. But it doesn't make him the be-all and end-all of quarterback.
What makes it, to my, in my opinion, so egregious or so disappointing and so much a part of the story of Peyton Manning is exactly what you're talking about, is that during the regular season, he is one of the greatest, at least top three quarterbacks of all time, probably top two with Tom Brady, and to walk away with it with just one Super Bowl is certainly disappointing. And
as a regular season quarterback, he's the greatest of all time. As a regular season quarterback, there's no question.
Sure. I mean, I will definitely have that conversation a lot more willingly than defending his playoff record. That's not a road I'm willing to go down.
Peyton Manning in the playoffs averages 283.3 yards per game.
And that's a losing record. So,
okay, but he's played well. Will you take 283 yards a game from your quarterback? That should be enough for you to win. He's thrown 38 touchdowns in 24 playoff games. I mean, he's been
against good defenses, because good defenses are the teams that end up in the playoffs.
This is against the best teams.
I can't believe I'm sitting with two of the biggest Peyton Manning playoff defenders of all time.
Just Peyton Manning defenders.
Again,
don't necessarily lump in the playoffs. Just because we don't like judging a quarterback on wins
playoffs.
And losses.
You're mischaracterizing our argument. We're saying you can't judge the guy solely on the playoffs. That's what we're saying.
It's like judging the Cy Young on wins.
I just said he's a good regular season quarterback.
You can't, and you're saying that defending
his
playoff record. We're saying you can't lump all the credit for a win or a loss.
Let's put it all
on
Sunday.
The quarterback.
We'll see on Sunday who is right and who is wrong.
I'm not in for that.
When we come back, more interesting than this, I think at least. John Scott not going to be in the All-Star game, and apparently the NHL put the screws to the Coyotes to make sure it didn't happen. We'll talk about that. Maybe the Maple Leafs as well. But a little honky-tonk coming up next. Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Arden Zwelling, Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's John Gregg.
Don't you really want to know?
Okay, I was wondering who the father of my baby was.
All right, let's take a look. The Miss Cleo DNA test.
Whoa, 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 Miss Cleo. We're not going that far. You do the baby daddies, we'll stick to the sports. And so we bring you the Overly Bold Predictions issue. How many rings will Steph Curry win? What will become of the top players at the World Juniors? What will Marcus Stroman do next? Johnny Football will join. How many Canadians will go in the top five at the NHL draft? What will Mike Babcock do with Nazem Kadri? When DeMar DeRozan signs, Raptors fans will? What will the NFL ban next? And which league will embrace gambling first? Those are just a few of the 77 predictions and one guarantee we've got for you in 2016. In your mailbox soon if you subscribe, and if you don't, available for any of your devices.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand, absolutely free.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I just won that argument going into the break there, so we don't need to revisit Peyton Manning in the playoffs. Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Arden Zwelling.
Must be nice to be the guy who gets to talk first.
Sometimes you let...
I wish I had control of your microphone, too.
It's like when you're a parent, and sometimes you just let the kid win. Like, the kid just won't stop whining.
Stop complaining. Brady's better. Let's move on.
You can have your Happy Meal. Okay.
It's like like my two kids have been eating paint chips in the garage their entire lives. And I don't have the heart to tell them that.
That was harsh.
Yeah,
I feel bad now.
What do you got against paint? Paint's playoff record is excellent.
All right. Please, let's move on.
Let's talk about an all-star.
One that might have been in John Scott.
The almost star.
Talk about things that don't matter, yeah.
What's John Scott's playoff record?
So John Scott is no longer... in Arizona with the Coyotes. He wasn't in Arizona even when he was with Arizona, because he was sent down to the AHL before he was dealt to Montreal Canadiens, and now back in the AHL, and does not look like he will participate in that, I don't know, at least moderately interesting 3-on-3 tournament in Nashville coming up, the All-Star game. And there are reports that really the NHL orchestrated this a little bit, at least pushed for this. Because it felt embarrassed by the way he was voted in to the All-Star game by the fans.
I think they're happy it happened.
Yeah, for
they're
sure.
They're definitely not
and it
upset.
It was embarrassing.
Although John Scott did his best to play it up, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're John Scott and you have the little that he has to hold on to in his professional
NHL
career.
It was the greatest thing that ever happened to his NHL career.
And reports were that both the team and the league asked him to relinquish his All-Star spot, and he said no. I'd probably do the same thing, frankly. Although I wouldn't be attacking Phil Kessel in a preseason game. But if I was an all-star...
I might be.
That's what he's there to do.
That's exactly right. That's what he's there to do. This is going to happen, though, when you've got fans voting in all-stars. When you give the power to the fans, like they do in Major League Baseball. And Arden, we talked about this before we came on the air, that there was potential for... a similar type embarrassment for Major League Baseball last year, and it was just barely avoided.
Yeah, absolutely. We did talk about that.
This is where you talk about what we talked about on the air, because we weren't on the air when we talked about
it. Yeah, I mean, people remember the Kansas City Royals almost had 9 starters voted into the All-Star game. I mean, it's not a product of fan choice, because fans have had choice for a very long time. We all remember going to the ballpark as kids and punching out little holes in the ballot and putting it in the thing.
And trying to maybe get one more ballot so you could get 2 votes.
Fans have had choice for a long time. It's a product of now fans have the internet on which you can organize campaigns like this. You can organize towards, reaching these goals, whether it be getting all the Royals in the All-Star game or John Scott into the All-Star game. So it's a kind of a different world now. I think we should banish all All-Star games altogether, but they make too much money for the leagues, so they're not going to do that. But I have no time for them.
Yeah, All-Star games, as much as they're pointless to a huge extent, I remember loving them as a kid. When you're a kid, you just want to see the best players play against the other best players. And it's cool because the guy from your team is now playing on the same team with the guy from your rival. And to be honest, this 3-on-3 tournament was the first thing I can remember in several years that has actually gotten me, I won't say super excited, but, interested. Like, I'm going to watch. I'm going to watch because 3-on-3 has been a hit. It's been fun. And I was one of those guys who originally looked at the John Scott thing and said, oh, this is crap. Why do you want to bring this enforcer to the All-Star game? Like, you're making a joke of it. And why? They should just not let him come. And then I read after this whole thing went down yesterday that he was having T-shirts made to give out to his teammates. And he was really looking forward to the weekend. And his wife is pregnant with twins and she's in Arizona. And now I just feel like an evil jerk for not wanting John Scott to be an All-Star.
Well, that's the part of it. It was like... It was not in good fun, right? Like, it was not in good... It's not like the people that voted John Scott in thought, oh, this is a super nice guy, underrated, scrappy guy.
No, they were trying to embarrass him.
Yeah, they were trying to embarrass him and the league, mostly.
Yeah, and it worked. Yeah.
And it did. And I guess this is the pushback.
It's like to Jordan's point though about liking it being 3-on-3. Like it's not going to be competitive 3-on-3. It's going to be like half speed guys trying to set each other up. Right? Like it sucks to be a goalie in those games.
Well, it always sucks to be a goalie in the All-Star game.
Well, those goalies don't exactly go post to post to try to keep those pucks out either. So
that's what I've always found like really like strangely depressing about All-Star games is it's these like massively talented athletes, massively skilled individuals using none of their skill. Right? Like
Did you fault them
competing.
Though? No, you can't fault them at all.
I absolutely am not faulting them at all. But I'm just saying that's what I've always found sad about the exercise, why I've never liked it. I've always enjoyed the skills competitions because that's when you get to see like, hey, can you hit the four corners in four shots? Hey, how many three-pointers can you hit Jason Capono, right? Let's see some sick dunks.
Yeah, Steph Curry.
Jason Capono. Yeah. That was a nice throwback right there.
Yeah, buddy. Let's see some sweet dangles on a breakaway, right? Let's see fastest skater. Like, let's see you actually use these like prodigious skills and talents that you have and test who is the best of these things. Well, I always loved that aspect
of it. This is why I'm excited about 3-on-3. And I don't want to put myself in the position of defending All-Star games because that's a bad position to be in. But 3-on-3 has been a huge success in the NHL. And I can sort of see it working in that it finds that middle ground between this half-assed All-Star game that we've had for so long and the skills competition, which you like, right? There's so much more space on the ice. You know, guys will try dangles and there won't be any like, oh, you should hit them because there's no hitting in 3-on-3 anyway because there's so much space out there. So you won't see those passed up body checks so much that you see in the All-Star game that reminds you just exactly how little they care.
I think that they should show, if they're going to do 3-on-3, make it like half the rink. Because I can see these guys moving so slowly. Can't you? Like, there's not going to be any rushes where
they're
like,
have two
really
games happening at the same time. Like, yeah. Put an extra board right on the red line.
Yeah. Or, like, just make it, like, you know, one end, right? I think that would be better.
Or multi-puck. Two pucks at the same time.
Like, you're going to get a lot of guys slowly coasting, like, through the neutral zone, right? It's going to be an exhibition of slow 2-on-1s. Basically.
Which is what the skills competition is, too, though.
Well, no, in the skills competition, like, guys are really trying to go fast in the fastest skater.
Oh, in the fastest skater.
They're really
trying to want the hardest shot and stuff. But right? I'm just thinking more of they do that, like, 2-on-1 breakaway relay or whatever the heck it is they do.
I don't know what that is. But you look at what the NBA has with like the pass, shoot, and whatever, right? Like the dribble and stuff like that. Guys are trying to beat each other's times. Like, that's interesting to me. And that's inherent competition where nobody's going to get hurt. It's actually interesting to watch and to see who has the best handles and who can, you know, create that kind of an obstacle course like on the ice, right? Where you got to pass and shoot and do all these things, right? Like, do it like that. That's interesting to me rather than just, you know, slow, like half-assed hockey.
It was slow.
Watered-down hockey.
That's why I kind of thought it would be interesting to see John Scott participate in it. Yeah. It's not like he was going to have a problem keeping up because it was going to be slow.
Yeah.
The only fun thing really about seeing John Scott in the game would have been seeing his teammates like try to set him up, right?
Because
you want to be that guy who gets John Scott a hat trick in the All-Star game. They would have embraced that.
Before we go, I know, Jordan, you want to talk about that Penguins trade that they just swung on Friday night as the Penguins, one of the more disappointing teams in the NHL, and they trade with another one of the most disappointing teams in the NHL, the Anaheim Ducks, as the Penguins send forward David Perron, defenseman Adam Clendenning to the Ducks for Carl Hagelin. I think you like this move for the Penguins, don't you?
I do. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm super excited to talk about it, but for a depth move, it's pretty good. I mean, when the Penguins acquired Perron from Edmonton, I think they were really, really hoping that he would just latch on to Sidney Crosby's line or at least an Evgeny Malkin's line. And his numbers with both of them have been pretty disappointing for somebody who, you know, gets enough chances playing with those great players. And Hagelin's been a guy who doesn't get a lot of credit, but is a pretty decent possession player, I think. Can produce, you know, with skilled players. So I'd like to see him. Really, for me, the Penguins just adding another piece and shaking it up a little bit because Perron clearly wasn't working. Might do well for him.
Penguins lose in Tampa to the Lightning 5-4 in overtime is Nemestikov with the hat trick. Speaking of hat tricks, Patrick Kane with his first regular season regulation hat trick as the Blackhawks beat the Maple Leafs, and now the Leafs losers of four straight. And sure, it's tough opponents, and they go into California and get those tough matchups, although they win the first game in Anaheim. Then they come home and lose to a horrible Blue Jackets team. This might be the beginning of the end of the positivity surrounding the Toronto Maple Leafs, might it?
I don't know if they're going to plummet, like, and, you know, fall off a cliff, to borrow a Brian Burke term. But, I mean, yeah, it's not, it was never going to be a good season. But I think there are still, you know, when you look at what the steps Nazem Kadri has taken, the steps Tyler Bozak's taken, if you look at the fact that, you know, Jonathan Bernier was able to overcome whatever was, you know, ailing him earlier in the year, there are certainly, you know, I do think there's still positivity. And I do think you kind of have to see the forest through the trees a little bit.
Also, there's not a lot of room for them to plummet, given that there's only two teams in the league that have fewer points than them, and Columbus is the worst team in the league, and the Leafs have three more points than Columbus. So when we talk about plummeting, let's be clear that they're almost at the bottom of the cliff. It's more like rolling the last few feet.
Yeah, but if they end up at the bottom of the standings at the end of the season, will we?
Fantastic.
It would certainly seemingly be right according to plan as far as continuing to rebuild and getting the most ping pong balls, but would we still be okay in talking about how successful this season has been and how great a coach Mike Babcock has been? I'm not saying we shouldn't, but would the conversation among fans still be that if they were 30th, if they finished 30th and by a wide margin?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that fans in this market, which is supposedly one of the most educated hockey markets in the world, you know, this is the capital of hockey. It's Toronto. And if you have fans that can look at this Maple Leafs team and see them possessing the puck so much more, not getting badly outshot every night, competing with everybody, like, I was at the game last night against the Blackhawks, and the Blackhawks were coming off a back-to-back, so they were pretty sluggish to start the game. But for the first half of that game, the Leafs were competing with them. It wasn't, you know, it was pretty clear that eventually the Blackhawks would show up and talent would take over, and that's what generally happens with this Leafs team. But you got to remember, they're playing with almost no talent, especially now that Van Riemsdyk's out. There's zero skill players on this team beyond Nazem Kadri, Morgan Riley, and I don't know if you want to qualify Jake Gardner as that. Is he? He still makes a lot of mistakes.
Right. He's had a good season, though, generally, in the overall this year, and a step forward.
For sure, but, like, I mean, when you look at teams that have a real promising future, you know, you see a lot of talent, like real guys. You can be like, this guy could be a game breaker one day. And when you look at the Leafs, you see those guys on the Marlies.
Yeah, and we see one of those guys working his way back to full health, maybe a William Nylander sighting before the season's over. That'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. Peyton Manning stinks in the playoffs. I'm Ben Annis, alongside Jordan Heath-Rawlings and Arden Zwelling. It is the Sportsnet Radio Network.